Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 181 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. Et maintenant, pour nos amis francophones, bonjournée auditeurs infidèles, et bienvenue à l'épisode 181 du podcast Diddly Dum, le quatrième meilleur podcast du monde à propos médecins sans qui. Mais rappelez-vous que vous ne pouvez pas voter pour votre propre planète. D'accord?
D'accord!
I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
Welcome, one and all, to the world's premier Swedish Doctor Who podcast, where we're still celebrating our great win at Eurovision last week, aren't we, boys?
Ah, oh, yeah.
It felt like our Waterloo, didn't it, really?
Oh, dear.
Oh, come on, Doc. How could I ever refuse?
Of course, you know, there are loads of people going now, aren't they, saying it was a fix to make sure that ABBA's 50th anniversary was in Sweden.
Were they really? They thought it was a fix?
No, you know how people talk about after their arses sometimes. But you must know, you've known us too long enough, haven't you?
Yeah, you've been on the internet, Hayden.
Speaking of talking out your arses, I have an opinion about Eurovision.
Oh, do share.
When I came in from the pub, Sophie was watching the results, and I saw that we were second from last. I said to Sophie, oh, I see the goodwill of us supporting the Ukraine last year has finally dried up.
No, I would say that last year, I think Sam Ryder's song was extraordinarily good quality, actually, and proper anthemic. And I would suggest that as nice as Mae Muller is, and as, you know, agreeable as her song may be, it was kind of seemed fairly sort of by the numbers Europop, really. Yeah. It didn't really stand out, so I'm not greatly surprised.
I hadn't been following it, and I listened the day before the final to her song on YouTube. I thought, oh, it's okay. I mean, the chorus, I thought, oh, that's quite catchy. But unfortunately, when she came to perform it on the night, it just didn't seem to be any va-va-voom in it.
No.
I actually preferred the Austrian song, the Edgar Allan Poe one. That was the favourite of the ones that I actually
saw. That was
saw.
Strange, yeah. I'd have been quite happy to put forward Midwich as our European representatives.
What about the Exploding Plastic Guitar Band? We've been looking for a gig for 15 years.
I'm quite happy to take a chance on you.
Whee.
And, of course, the very best thing about Eurovision was the revelation to a wider audience of the glorious and fabulous Hannah Waddingham. Oh!
Can I task you two with a challenge?
Yeah.
I think in this episode we have to try and fit in as many Eurovision song titles as possible.
Oh, I didn't, slipped one in, nobody noticed.
Well, you slipped one in, I've slipped one in, and Doc slipped one in, and at some point I've got to somehow slip in Power to All Our Friends or something.
Hayden, I'm the maitre d' of this podcast. Don't you try treating us like a puppet on a string.
Whee. It's all right. Save your kisses for me, Doc.
Crowbar.
Glenn Hoddle, when he was England manager, as a game, tasked the England players whenever they gave an interview during the tournament, that they had to fit in song titles into the interviews.
Right. I spent the week searching streaming channels on the internet for the further work of Hannah Waddingham. I've been binge-watching, what's that football thing she's in? Ted Lasso.
Oh,
on
Ted
Apple.
Lasso? Is that any good?
It's one of those things that it's not... You say, oh, this just isn't realistic. It's one of those things that I think we should have far more shows which portray the world as it ought to be rather than as it is ever likely to be. It's quite nice. And the landlady of the local pub is the new love of Mark's life. Annette Badland.
Ah!
Is she really? She isn't it too?
Yeah. It's quite good, actually.
Okay.
It's very silly. And I'm afraid Mark will not watch it, because for most of the second series, the baddies are West Ham.
No.
Hang on, we have to enter a conjunction there. European Cup finalists, West
well,
Ham.
Yeah, but I don't want to mention it, because I'm afraid of jinxing it, so... especially because who knows when this podcast is going to go out. I may already be weeping.
I was going to say, you could just cover your bases by saying European Conference League runners-up West Ham.
No, I'm just not going to be drawn on this.
Who are you playing, Mark?
They've got Fiorentina, is it? In the final, yeah.
I'll be keeping my gaze away from European results for a few months.
Oh.
Of course, in the run-up to Eurovision on finals night, we had, finally, the combined trailer for the three new specials coming up in November for Doctor Who.
Mm.
The Star Beast, Wild Blue Yonder, and The Giggle. Any thoughts? I didn't think they were particularly revealing, to be honest.
The Star Beast... is obviously the one that's got us most excited, I think, as a fan base, from what I've seen online and from how I feel.
Yeah.
Beat the Meep is going to be, by the looks of it, quite a fun adventure. So I'm liking the looks of that. The Giggle was... that'll be interesting. I mean, the jury's out until we've seen the episodes, aren't they, really?
Mm. Yeah, you can't judge. I've seen people online saying... Do you know what? I think The Giggle, I think that might actually turn out to be quite a sinister thing. I was like, no kidding.
Yeah.
Of course it's going to be.
It's Susan. It's going to be Susan.
No.
It's the Rani or whatever, you know. It's just every time a female would be cast as a baddie in Doctor Who, they were always the next Rani. Sarah Lancaster's going to be the Rani. Just, yeah, crazy. But, they look all right, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
It's exciting. You know, Doctor Who... Yeah. Doctor Who trailers 5 months before they're actually going to be shown is... it's good.
Hmm.
It's keeping the fact that something big is coming in the public.
How many outfits is Shooty Gatwa's Doctor going to have?
Yeah, I know.
Every time they're obviously filming for a new episode and they release a photo shoot of him in another period... sort of outfit, and it's astonishing, really. It's it helps, I suppose, that he's such a clothes horse, really, isn't he? So
it makes sense for because when you think about it now, you look back and John Pertwee was always wearing like a different variant of something, you know, of his crushed velvet jacket and the frilly shirt and everything, but he never wore the same thing simultaneously in stories. Tom Baker's costume used to alternate as well. I think it's only really since probably Peter Davison where the Doctor was just like uniform the whole way through, even if the companions weren't. But it makes sense. I mean, even like the Ninth Doctor would change his jumper every now and then. So it I don't know, freshens things up. And it, in a way, it sort of adds to an element of fun, I guess, really, that the Doctor, instead of just thinking, oh, I'll just waltz into this as I am because I'll just, you know, blend in wherever I am when clearly he or she doesn't.
Mm.
This time it's like, no, actually we're in, I don't know, the early 1800s, so I'll dress up as a Georgian or something, you know.
I wonder if that's kind of more part of Shooty's Doctor's character in a way, that he loves dressing up for the occasion.
Yeah, why not? And also, it's going to give character options probably enough money from action figures to...
Yeah, because I want to get a 60s funk 15th Doctor. That'd be the one I'd go for. He looks amazing in that outfit with his little afro. It's amazing.
Yeah, it looks great, doesn't it? I think it looks good. I think it's just exciting to see it coming back again. There's no seems to be... Although I have seen that there's quite a few people who are quite sad, not just people in fandom, but the non-we are kind of like, why is David Tennant back? Why is Catherine Tate back? And so I've seen some naysayers now that Murray Gold's back as well, saying, you know, how can this be new and refreshing if they're just getting everyone back from, what was it, 15 years ago, 14 years ago? But we're just going to have to see, aren't we?
Yeah, well, the programme was at its peak then. And, you know, it's shed a lot of viewers since that time, hasn't it? And so I think, in a way, I think it's not bad having, you know, it's only for the specials, isn't it, really, that it's all the old team. And so, you know, it kind of will drag people back in, people who perhaps wouldn't have bothered watching, be something nice and familiar to them, but new as well. And so I think it's a fairly sound tactic to get viewers back. So I'm not complaining about it, and see how it goes when Shooty gets going properly on his own, I guess.
Well, anyone who saw her reading out the results of the British jury at Eurovision will have seen that Catherine Tate's easy, sophisticated charm hasn't changed from a few years ago.
No, I saw on something else a day or two after as well, and she seems to be wearing these outfits that make it look like she's got three heads.
Yeah. Lord knows what the rest of Europe was thinking. It seems to be one of those things that we seem to do particularly well in the UK. Here's something that I'm going to talk about. It's hilarious, despite the fact that only really people in the UK, and possibly a few in Australia, are going to have any conception of A, who I am, and B, what it is that I'm full of myself about. But there we are.
Apparently some non-Doctor Who French Eurovision fans were watching, and when she came on, she said, "Allons-y!" They were like, "Oh, look, she's going to give France 12 points. Oh, bless them.
Isn't there supposed to be a new amazing Doctor Who character that they've announced or something?
Oh, the drag person with the musical motif outfit. Oh, God, I can't remember what they're called now.
Jinx Monsoon.
Yes, that's the one.
Does that rather sound like one of Jabba the Hutt's henchmen, doesn't it?
It does a little.
I must admit, I've never watched RuPaul's Drag Race or whatever that was. For a number of years, I assumed that was some kind of speed racing thing. I didn't realise it had to do with drag in that sense. Jinx has cultivated an international fan base. I wonder if she's given a comment.
Oh.
Jinx Monsoon said, "I am honoured, thrilled and utterly excited to join Doctor Who. Russell T. Davies is a visionary and a brilliant writer. I can't help to get into the weeds with him and the crew." The weeds? With him and the crew. "I hope there's room in the TARDIS for my luggage." Yeah. Well, it's no mention of being beyond excited to be doing that.
Wow.
Obviously, these three episodes are apparently to be put into November later this year. Broadcast on BBC One in the UK and Ireland, and on Disney Plus internationally. Further to which, I did hear one rumour at Capital that apparently any spin-offs that they do arising from the stuff they're doing with Bad Wolf, let's say they do a Torchwood spin-off or whatever, are apparently only going to be on Disney. They won't be on BBC.
Yeah.
Which I found quite surprising.
Well, I don't think that the BBC, I don't think it knows what to do with BBC Three anymore. It's like it's that plan to bring it back has kind of gone a little bit tits up, and I don't know whether that would be the best place for these things. And also, I suppose when you think about it, going out online on a big distributor like Disney can bring in millions of viewers potentially, whereas if they were just to promote it on BBC Two or BBC Three, then they might get, what, 1 million, 2 million? Maybe 3 on iPlayer?
Well, Class didn't even get that, did it?
Class didn't even get a million, I don't think, did it? It was very poor.
Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me if BBC probably got nothing to do with spin-offs at all financially, so that would probably make sense that Disney would maintain the rights, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
The only thing is, I mean, Disney do have a habit, though, of dropping stuff on their streaming services as well, don't they? They've just dropped a load of stuff recently. They've cut loads and loads of films and shows. So there's a problem with streaming services. You know, that people think, oh, I don't need to buy stuff. I can watch it all on Amazon. I can watch it all on Netflix and stuff. But unfortunately, these things don't stay around, do they?
No.
If you love something, buy it. Don't leave it to the streaming people to bring it to you.
No, completely. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see people moving back to physical media again, very much in the way that in the world of music, You've got cassettes are now back in vogue. Cassettes, they were the worst musical format, you know. Forever breaking.
Oh, it's great. As long as you take a pencil out with you so you can rewind the tape without without using up your batteries.
Exactly. But it was in the way, because now you look at it like vinyl outsells CD, but CDs come back a little bit as well. Cassettes are now coming out again, which I think is bloody mad. But anyway, there we go. The thing is, with streaming services, is there's always a rights issue further down the line, whether it be initially or further down the line. Now, a lot of rap artists from the late 70s, early 80s, well, through to the 90s, when they used sampling, a lot of that tied them up with copyright, which meant that bands like De La Soul, A Tribe Called Quest, their Grandmaster Flash couldn't be on streaming sites until very recently in De La Soul's case, which is just a load of rubbish, because if you have the CD or you have it on your iPod or whatever from back in the day, then you can just listen to it whenever. And I've been thinking about this recently, like with regards to DVDs, I've cleared everything out of my house except The Simpsons. And the only reason why I've kept The Simpsons is because it is, for me, that's on par with Doctor Who as my favourite programme of all time. But because it went over to Disney Plus, they changed, Mark will go livid at this, they changed the aspect ratio on the early episodes. They cleaned them up to a point where they were so squeaky clean that you could see the pencil marks underneath the big, thick, dark lines of the outlines of the characters every now and then.
Yeah.
And also, where content is now deemed sensitive, it's been cut from the episodes. And even in the case of the opener of season one is Stark Raving Dad, which is the episode with Michael Jackson in it. That's not available on Disney Plus anymore. So if you really want to be king of your own domain, as it were, I do think it is best to hold on to this stuff.
Well, like I was going to say, I've still got my original Star Wars trilogy on VHS, which was pre-George Lucas going back and re-releasing them all as special editions and then getting rid of the originals. So
there was one release on DVD, which was a double release of the original trilogy, back from 2003 or 2004, I think it was, where you had the special edition on one disc and you had the original on another disc. And I've got them. They're downstairs, sorry, as well. Films, I have got a few on DVD that I haven't got on Blu-ray. But this does tie in actually quite nicely with things I've been seeing on Twitter recently with regards to, is it the Australian Blu-ray collection sets for Doctor Who are no longer being pressed in Australia?
Yeah.
Yes, I've seen a few of our podcasting colleagues down under exploding about that.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, that's the only thing that makes me worry. I think Universal were making, Rob Owens probably screaming down his podcatcher right now listening to this, saying, no, Hayden, you're getting it all wrong. Stop getting Doctor Who wrong. But from what I gather, I think Universal...
Hang on, that's my line!
Universal own the publishing rights to the Doctor Who, the collection. And I don't know why. I don't know whether it's due to poor sales or whether it's due to the fact that people just aren't buying Blu-rays out there, that they've terminated distribution. So the only way for people to continue to get the collection in Australia is if they import it from the UK. So, I mean, we definitely know that the collection isn't stopping because of the amount of work and the amount of hints and things that people keep saying online from, you know, Chris Chapman and even convention goers. You know, this Peter Davison season 20, and it's been rumoured for years, but apparently that's the next one. I know we said that's six sets back, but anyway, there we go. So we know they're not going to stop. But I'm now slightly worried that since I've got rid of all my DVDs and I'm just waiting for the Blu-rays to come out, that they could pull the plug on physical media as well. But I don't think it'll happen. I think there will be a renaissance in physical media. And it could be everything. It could be people might go back to VHS. Honestly, I really do think this could happen.
No, stop getting Bond wrong!
People still are buying VHS. I follow a lot of horror Twitter timeline stuff, and they're always releasing horror films on VHS still because of the cachet it's got, because it goes back to that whole thing of the video nasties and that whole period. So it's got that whole vibe about it. So people actually like to buy their horror films on these special released VHS cassettes still.
Well, isn't that interesting? There we are then. It will happen, because what's going to happen is the streaming sites are just going to continue to take things off. And then it will... There's only two ways that you can watch something then. It'll either be through pirate torrent sites, or it'll be physical media.
Was it Josh Snares who I saw on Twitter who bought a television and set it up and their DVD player or their Blu-ray player so that they can watch Doctor Who Blu-rays and DVDs, but they appear on screen exactly as they would have done when they were broadcast?
Yeah.
And there is a part of me that really appeals to, because whenever I'm watching the extras on those discs and they go to like the old TV links, which are obviously haven't been cleaned up at all, and they're all as recorded from the television at the time.
Mm.
And when I watch those, I get such a frisson of nostalgia and like a real powerful sense of being a kid and watching them at that time, that I don't get when I'm watching the cleaned up episodes, but I do when I'm watching like those old, how many lines is it?
425.
When I'm watching the old 425 line broadcasts. So I can see the appeal, although I still don't know why you'd want to listen to music on tape cassettes.
That's interesting, because there's a store near me that sells this kit, which you can use to watch Doctor Who DVDs or Blu-rays, and it makes it seem like you're watching the omnibus broadcasts on UK Gold on early Sunday mornings in the early 90s.
What?
What this kit is, it's a bottle of vodka and a kebab, which you consume the previous night. And, oh, the effect is amazing.
We had a Christmas cassette, right, from the mid-80s. And I remember being in the car once. We're coming back from North London, just been to see my uncle. And I got Queen's, thank God it's Christmas, is going on. And all of a sudden it starts going, Freddie Mercury starts going, Christmas. And at that point, it just started spewing out. It was a bit like, you know, when you win the jackpot on a fruit machine, it just goes coming out. And at that point, my dad said, right, better get the CD out then.
But it's Identity Attractions cassette, but I do think this whole thing with streaming services will together. And you've got to remember as well.
But it's, I don't see the attraction to cassette, but I do think this whole thing with streaming services will tip you over the edge. And you've got to remember as well, the people who run Doctor Who are very much aware of how enthusiastic Doctor Who fans are, yeah, about collecting things on physical media anyway. So I'm fairly certain these spin-offs will come out on Blu-ray and the rest of it eventually, but there we go.
I suppose at the end of the day, Hayden, if you've always got some mug you know who'll rip it for you, it doesn't really matter if you've got rid of your DVDs or not.
Thank you.
What sort of region do they have in Australia? America's Region 1 and we're Region 2.
Yeah, it's Region 2. Australia and UK are the same, so it's...
Sensible things. Same as the way they drive on the proper side of the road as well.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a look at back at Capitol again, this time as fans, where we can really let rip without Tony in the room. This is what we do. Talking of sci-fi conventions, Hayden, isn't it coming up in June?
Yeah, on June 17th and 18th, there's an event going on called Brit Sci-Fi at the National Space Centre in Leicester. And it's celebrating 60 years of Doctor Who, 50 years of The Tomorrow People, 45 years of Blake Seven, and 40 years of Terrorhawks. They've got Daleks there, they've got all the Gerry Anderson series going to be there, they've got puppets and the models from the Gerry Anderson series, they've got Red Dwarf is celebrated there as well. You've got the likes of Katie Manning, Janet Fielding, Sophie Aldred, David Bradley, Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, Paul McGann, Sally Yvette, Jan Chappelle. They've got some weekend shows there as well. So they've got, in the Sir Patrick Moore Planetarium, there's an informal Q&A with Daleks. There's an audience with the Daleks, which should be interesting. Yeah, they've got the Gerry Anderson podcast live. That'll be excellent. They've got Doctor's Q&A. They've got Blake Seven Q&A.
Tomorrow People.
The Tomorrow People. Avenue Q's there. Doctor Who costume exhibition. Like I said, Anderson Alley. So there's a huge display of Anderson's spacecraft vehicles, puppets, original pieces from shows, and the TARDIS interior that we saw in 2018, was it?
Yeah.
All sorts of workshops going there as well. It looks really good. It's £17 for adults.
Oh, that's not bad, is it?
I think it's like £5 for children, I think, as well. So it looks pretty damn decent. And it's going to be the first convention that me and Sophie are taking William to. In fact, it's going to be Sophie's first convention as well.
Because she's a normal human being, isn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, she's been unsullied up until now. But since William's shown such a great enthusiasm for especially Gerry Anderson stuff and really likes space, he really likes Daleks now as well. He was terrified of them a little while ago, but I got the character options box out of the loft of all the toys. So he's been playing with them. And we've played a game now with the with our Zygon, and he copies me and he goes, I go, William, where's your Zygon gone? And he really laughs about it and then copies, which is very cute. Yeah, so we'll be there. So come and say hi.
Oh, that's lovely.
And do join us, lads, if you're able to as well.
Is his favourite doctor, Dr. Tumble, going to be there?
Yes, Mr. Tumble Doctor, yes. He wants to take his Mr. Tumble Doctor figure and meet Mr. Tumble.
If anyone doesn't know, that's Colin Baker's multicoloured jacket reminds young William of Mr. Tumble, a children's TV presenter over here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Mr. Tumble!
I don't know how Colin Baker will react when William says to him, Mr. Tumble Doctor. We'll have to see, I guess.
Mark and Hayden had to draw this to my attention because not having any kids of my own, I've not watched kids television since I was in my 40s.
Oh, yeah.
So, links in the show notes as ever, faithlessisters at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Oh, talking of things being online, as well as now being available on Instantaneous Gramophone. So that's Instagram, isn't it? As well as being available on Spotify, we are now also available on Amazon Music. Something which possibly I should have sorted out before we went to the trouble of re-recording all our end credits. Or at least and before Hayden and I got around to doing it. So it may be some years before we get around to re-recording those again, listeners. 15th and 16th of April, in fact, just almost exactly a month ago, all three of us were at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Crawley for Capital Six Decades. When we podcasted with Tony Jordan last time, shortly after coming home from it, we gave the official line on it. So what are we going to say that was more honest now?
I'll tell you one thing which happened. At one point on the Sunday, this was the biggest goof I made of the entire weekend, right? And there were a couple.
And that's saying something, listeners.
On the weekend, yeah, it was a quiet one for me. On the Sunday, we'd just come out doing an interview. I think it was the Gary Russell and Phil Ford interview. And we settled down in the bar area and they had the West Ham Arsenal game on the telly. And it was 2-0 to the Gooners. I was thinking, oh God, here we go. Anyway, I went off somewhere, came back, and all of a sudden it was 2-2. And as I'm going to sit down with Mark, I'm shouting to Mark and going, it's Desmond! It's Desmond! It's Desmond, look! Desmond as in...
Desmond 2-2.
Desmond 2-2. 2-2 would be in the score. At which point, poor Dean Hollingsworth...
Well, I turned round to see what on earth Hayden was pointing at, and he was basically... In the direction that Hayden was pointing, there was just a slightly bewildered-looking Dean Hollingsworth standing there with his mouth slightly open, going, huh? And Hayden was just appeared to be pointing at him, shouting, it's Desmond, Mark. Look, it's Desmond. And I was just looking at Dean Hollingsworth, thinking, they only did the interview about 2 hours ago, and they've already forgotten my name.
It was really embarrassing. Not as embarrassing as the moment when Mark and I were in the green room with Wendy Padbury trying to negotiate the time that we were going to interview her. And I embarrassed myself then, Mark, as well, didn't I?
Hello! Was that what you mean?
Yeah.
Hello! A little wave. So suddenly went all camp, didn't you?
Well, they all of a sudden turned into Charles Hawtrey, yeah.
Oh, Hayden did. I thought you meant she did.
No, Hayden did.
Yeah, because I don't know why, but even though I've met her before? Yeah, I have met her before at a convention about 10 years ago. But I've never spoken to her properly, and I don't know why. I think I said it on our interview, but you know how you boys have said in the past, you look at her and she's not really changed much since the 60s. Something in my brain made me 8 years old again.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, it's Zoe. Hello, Zoe.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, so that was my other embarrassing moment. I think that was it. That was my weekend. Oh, no, there was a third, actually, gents, which I don't think I mentioned to you, but on the Saturday, Mark and I ordered pizzas from a local Domino's, and I didn't know the local area, but it was only like half a mile up the road, but I got lost walking there, so I thought, oh, screw this, I'm just going to jump in the car and drive there instead. And then realised on the trip back that half the journey had been in a bus lane, going past a lot of cameras and traffic lights, being the only one there thinking, oh, if this is quiet, and then I realised at the very end...
Oh, you haven't had any fines, have you?
Well, so I ended up thinking, oh, God, and this might be my jammiest thing. I didn't get any correspondence with regards to that at all. So I got away with it, driving in the bus lane to get me and Mark our pizzas.
Well, I was the jammy one. I was not for most of the weekend, really, because not only did I get some stick from Tony, which was very fortunate because I turned up with my sciatica, barely able to walk. And yeah. Fortunately, Tony had a walking stick in the back of his car, which he'd brought with him. And I was able to use that for the weekend, which saved me ever such a lot of discomfort and pain over the course of the weekend. So thank you. I'm not sure I'd mentioned this on the podcast with Tony, but thank you for giving me some stick. So yeah, that was much appreciated. And then also was really lucky because I bumped into Wendy Padbury outside and then got an interview with her. Then bumped into Gary Russell in the elevator, managed to get an interview with him, and then asked if we could do it with Phil Ford as well. And who was downstairs waiting outside the elevator, but it was Phil Ford. So Gary Russell was, well, here's Phil here. Why don't you ask him? So, and he said yes. So, and that was all in the space of about half an hour. We'd suddenly gone from having just the one interview lined up to suddenly having four.
Would you have known Phil if you'd seen him?
No, I wouldn't.
Because I was just thinking, if you were to do that, make sure there's no one else in the lift. Because when you say, oh, I just wish we could have Phil Ford, do you? And you find out that the other guy in the lift is actually Phil Ford himself.
Yeah.
Or it could work the other way around. We end up interviewing someone who isn't to do with Doctor Who at all, because we think they are a certain person, a bit like the time BBC News interviewed that guy who got him for an interview.
Yes.
I was just thinking of him.
Phil Ford, but actually it's, I don't know, Dave Greenham or something like that.
You mean that embarrassing time when they phoned that guy up to ask him what they thought about Matt Smith's leaving Doctor Who? Was that Hayden? Is that what you meant?
Do you know the most embarrassing thing about that? Genuinely, about that story?
I know, you hadn't had time to gel your hair.
Almost. It was the fact that they told me while I was sitting on the toilet. And the next day, and they literally, out the blue, they called me up and said, oh, hello, I'm the producer of Radio 5 Live. Don't tell anyone this, but Matt Smith's leaving Doctor Who. It's the most confusing poo I've ever had.
Oh. Well.
I didn't put that in the book.
Readers, why don't you email in with the most confusing poos you've ever had?
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
Let's go back now. We were talking about the speculation about who might be the next Doctor Who, because Matt Smith has confirmed that he's going to stop playing the role in November. Let's now speak to Hayden Gribble. He's from Doctor Who Online, the biggest fan website. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Right, OK. What did you think when you heard that Matt Smith was quitting?
They told me while I was sitting on the toilet. Out the blue, they called me up and said, don't tell anyone this, but Matt Smith's leaving Doctor Who. It's the most confusing poo I've ever had.
Hang on, computer. I think you might have got that mixed up. Could you rewind and try again, please?
Right, OK. What did you think when you heard that Matt Smith was quitting?
It came as a shock. It's come to a big shock to fandom as well.
I was just thinking, actually, I thought a bit of artwork we can do for the episode. It could be a fag packet, and on the back it can say, smoking may involve you picking up stars at conventions or something. For the amount of times Mark went outside and got us a gig.
You're never alone with a swan.
I thought Mark was our MVP of the weekend.
Yes, I thought that.
So well done, Mark. So it's actually better to have a smoker amongst our ranks who can hang outside and pick up the creme de la creme of the Doctor Who world. Then I've always said smokers are the most interesting people, and as that turns out to be, you know, so that's well done, my friend.
Does MVP stand for most valuable polluter?
Yeah, or Mark's valves, I don't know, something or other, I guess.
Mark's valve pollution.
Yeah, it was a good weekend.
Well, I do often think that you sort of put in a lot of legwork on the Saturday, and I think the last couple of years, and then you get, I mean, I don't know if this is going to be all that interesting for people to listen to be honest, but you put in a lot of legwork on Saturday, and quite often you won't see things, the fruits won't bear until the next day, so.
I think it takes the people at a convention, I think it takes people just the time to warm up as well, doesn't it? It's all quite tentative on the first day.
Yeah.
It's different with things like the Terence Dicks event, because that's a one day thing, so we can just get straight in, get the interviews that we get, and then come away feeling quite, you know, fulfilled. But I think my highlight of the Saturday was definitely the podcast with Gareth and Ian. I think that was a lot of fun.
Yes, it was, yeah, enjoyed that.
And how we ever made it out of that bunker alive with all the choices that we made.
Have you started sending your broken pieces of War of the Daleks to Tom's refurbishments yet, Mark?
No, see, I keep forgetting about that as well.
That's something else I'll nag you about.
Yeah, it's something I need to do. I keep forgetting.
Because I was planning to do that as to get him to take some photos and follow him as he... as he Tom's refurbishments, of course, I've heard us talking about Faithless Listeners. Tom is the chap who mends Daleks. And just before we went off to the Capitol this year, we gave a warning to Hall not to take him literally when he said, oh, well, I might be able to mend little toy Daleks. Yes, people should just come along with them and see them. Well, Mark had his, as promised, had his War of the Daleks board game out and operating in the bar. He realised that one of his little Daleks figures, the sort of weighted bottom bits had come detached and wouldn't go back on. So he asked Tom, you'd be able to redo this? So I think Tom works in part with, what do they call those machines?
3D printers.
With 3D printers.
Yeah, astonishing the stuff that he went. Actually, that was a good point of Saturday as well, actually, hanging around at his stall. He was talking us through how everything was made. And he had, like, little... How tall were those Daleks, Mark? They were, like, a centimetre tall, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, those little tiny... Yeah, those...
They were fantastic. They were really, really good.
About 7 millimetre high.
Yeah, I thought they were extraordinary. But it was a really fun weekend again.
Yeah, it was.
It's interesting, because I turned up... due to family commitments, or at least I thought I would have family commitments, so I didn't book a hotel for the Friday. In the end, I probably should have booked a hotel for the Friday, but I left at the crack of dawn on Saturday, drove right through the centre of London, which was an adventure, and got there. And the hotel itself, because I was that the venue for the convention last year?
Yes, it was.
No, so was that the Aurora before?
Yeah, this was the second year we've used that one.
I nearly had to. I blink and miss the Aurora because it was only about half a mile away from where the new hotel was. So yeah, I think the setup was good, and we were given our own media room this year too, weren't we? Which was pretty sweet.
And that's just it's basically just a quiet conference room, wasn't it? That wasn't being used. I mean, you call it a media room, it makes it sound like it's got banks of monitors and stuff all around it.
I then ended up, because I don't get the chance to normally have a childless evening where I can just stay up for as long as I want with, you know, reasonably, what, the convention started at 11 the next day, so I didn't really need to get up until, what, 10, half 10 at the earliest? So for that, I just let off steam in the evening, and I ended up, it was just me and Tash and Achilles standing at the bar at nearly 2 o'clock in the morning when everyone else had kind of gone to bed. talking about guitar playing techniques, of all things. So that was, yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, because you two came up to say goodnight, didn't you? And then you just, I don't know what time that was, but it was about midnight. Oh, okay. But we had a good chat. We had, you know, obviously, we were drinking with Ian and Gareth and friend of the show, Johnny Dabb. Then Dave came over, Dave Greenham, one of the, to quote Rev, Little Dwass Helpers, came over to spend time with us as well. And it's quite nice because, you know, as the years pass on of us going to these events, the more people you know and the more people you're more relaxed around, so then the more people that you can end up sort of spending time socialising with, you know, that's, really good, really good time.
Mark went up to bed early on Friday night. And so I was left alone in the bar. And then as soon as I sort of just stood out as being on my own on a bar table, the Cutaway Boys came over to me. They clearly prepared for last orders by having about four bottles of lager each with them. And then we got to talk about the most appalling gossip again. But I was texting Mark upstairs saying, "Quick, come down. We're having a great time." And Mark was texting back saying, "I knew you would as soon as I went upstairs."
I was too drained, tired, everything at that point. Oh, God, those bloody beds as well.
Oh, the beds were atrocious. And when I turned up on Sunday morning coming down wearing sunglasses, it wasn't because of a raging hangover. It was because my eyes were just so heavy and tired from lack of sleep. It was like sleeping on a bed of cement.
Mm, really was.
Really, really hard beds.
Yeah, there's no... You go to a hotel to like even cheapest hotels I've been to, you know, you get in a bed, you're like, oh, well, these beds are so nice, they're so big, so roomy, so comfy. You get here, oh, this bed, oh, look, it's huge, it's big, enormous bed, and oh, Christ, it's hard as rock.
Yeah, because it exacerbated your sciatica, didn't it?
Yeah, I was not in a good place when I came downstairs on the Saturday, but, you know, I did improve as the weekend went on, so. And we won't be there next year.
No.
This is me, 15th of April, that's the Friday night, it's, well, 20 past midnight. If you can't get to sleep, I'm with Gareth, Ian and Beef in the bar discussing a big group recording they want to do with us tomorrow night. Ideal for a... Mark replies, "Typical, I'm too tired and exhausted now. This is the sort of conversation I wanted to join in with earlier, before my brain ground to dust." So we got interviews with Dean Hollingsworth, which we put out on the end of our last podcast. At the end of this podcast, we'll be adding our interview together with Gary Russell and Phil Ford, which was really interesting. So we got into a lot of talk about what sort of work that showrunners actually did. We didn't quite know. I realised that Russell and Stephen went to that extent.
Yeah, it was a really interesting interview to do. I mean, I always enjoy our interviews, but I do think we did particularly well with them this year. I think they're really good interviews, really good interviews this year. Really pleased with all of them.
So I've got about a 45 minutes with Gary and Phil, obviously once it's been edited down. There's about a half hour one with Wendy Padbury. And there's about one with that I've got halfway through editing with Rob Sherman, which is still on. I've only got it down to 1 hour and a quarter at the moment. So it's going to present us with some difficulties unless we actually say, right, we will put out a podcast where we just say, spend 5 minutes introducing it, then we stick a large interview on the end. Because if we do a normal length podcast for us, or even a short length podcast for us, it will still make it enormously long just sticking interviews on the end of. So we'll have to see. I mean, maybe we'll have to see how it goes. But yes, it is nice that we've gradually met more and more people that we know, either that we've met at the conventions or that we've already knew. And oh, so you're that same. I mean, we meet, was it Capital 2 that the two of us, Mark, first met Andrea at?
Yes.
TARDIS Parrot?
Yeah.
And we see, and she's become a good friend. We see her every year now.
Hugh and Lisa, who we've got to know as well.
Hugh and Lisa. Yes, Lisa gave us a lecture on the outrage of how male Doctor Who fans only get to go to these conventions because clearly they're female partners are staying at home, looking after the children, looking after the pets, looking after the house, and how we should occasionally try it the other way around. Gareth and Ian from Cutaway are always good value for anything, really.
Yes.
And next year, of course, I think it was already said, it's going to be at the Holiday Inn in Birmingham. And I think only in the last couple of days the announcement has come out that rooms are now available for booking. And obviously that means that tickets are available for buying as well. So if you just go to the, just Google DWAS, D-W-A-S, and then Capitol with an O. And it's almost invariably will take you to the right website you need. Right, in that case, oh, who's this coming down the corridor to say goodbye? It's Uncle Brucey come to say goodbye.
Hold on, let me just warm him up. Just give him a rub. See, my chin does do that. So I have to do the chin, don't I, love? Don't I? Is that right, my dear? Yes, it is. I'm getting warmed up this time, anyway. Hello, boys.
Uncle Brucey, will you be coming along to Capitol 2024 with us?
Well, I'm still making my mind up, you know, because you've got to speed it up. And then you've got to slow it down. Because if you believe that our love can hit the top, you've got to play around.
Good grief.
Uncle Brucey, Uncle Brucey, thank you for the music.
Yeah, if you want to see some more, I've just whipped Hayden's trousers off. Sorry, Hayden.
Give them back, you Bruce.
Uncle Brucey, have you got any new advice for us?
Don't dump. Deuce points in the river, into the river, deuce points don't dump.
Uncle Brucey, Uncle Brucey. We have a suspiciously conveniently scheduled 50th anniversary of ABBA winning with Waterloo being hosted in Sweden next year.
It's a fix.
Bye-bye, everyone. Keep listening for our Gary Russell and Phil Ford interview following on now.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.
Capital. With DWM's Gary Russell and TV's Phil Ford.
Yeah. Hello. DWM's Gary Russell. I haven't been DWM's Gary Russell for nearly 40 years.
It was a good 10 years, though.
No, 30 years.
Yes, because I remember you on the more than 30 years, you were sitting on the Hoomobile.
I was sitting on the Hoomobile, yeah. And pretending that there was a dinosaur above us, and then a draconian turned up. But of course, I'd been the Auton, and I'd been the Destroyer. God, I mean,
really?
I don't look like Sarah Anton. And I'd been a hemivore, but I wasn't Phoebe.
You do get around, don't you?
I did back then, yeah.
Wow.
30 years in the TARDIS was just enormous fun because Kevin was, like, so full of energy and enthusiasm for what we were doing. Yeah. And the BBC, who were there the whole time, were really behind this. And it gave him the opportunity to do these little recreations of various things. And I just said, yes, I'd like to be an Auton breaking through a sheet of glass in a shop with a gun.
Is that was Mark Gatiss, Dalek? Going along Westminster Bridge.
It's Mark. It's me, Nick Pegg, Barney Edwards, Alistair Locke. I think Mark might be in one of them on the bridge. He's not on one of the ones chasing Carol Ann Ford by the steps, because that's me and Nick Pegg. And there's a couple of other people on Westminster Bridge. There's a lot of us on Westminster Bridge. I could not control a Dalek to save my life. If you watch 30 Years in the TARDIS, you can clearly see which Dalek is Nick Pegg and which Dalek is me chasing Carol Ann Ford. Because Nick Pegg's going in a straight line and my Dalek is drunkenly doing this because I couldn't control it. I don't know how anyone controls
it's Daleks. It's a specialised job.
It really is difficult.
That's
really
why they have their own unions. We spoke to, there's a refurbishing company here, Tom's Refurbishment. Yeah. He's got the refurbishes Daleks. And he said that they have to have a Dalek insurance thing going on, like they have to be insured to.
I'm sorry, can we just backtrack a bit here? There is a company
whose
existence is refurbishing Daleks.
Yes. Yeah.
How do they get so much business?
Why does that surprise you? Come on. Daleks are very
popular. They're not real.
Well,
if you go to the if you go up to the people who are giving money to small businesses, say, "Hi, I'd like to start a small business. What would your small business be? I'm going to refurbish Daleks." I would imagine that the man behind the counter who's going to be giving the money
is putting the
money back in a drawer and locking it, going, "Yes," because they don't really exist.
But they do. They
the security.
Yep. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry, have I just broken some taboo secret by revealing that it's all fiction?
I think it's fascinating that there's a company that refurbishes Daleks. Because, I mean, the whole thing about everybody building their Daleks, you know, I had a friend who was building a Dalek. That's why I say it in the past tense, that he's no longer a friend. But yes, But what's this insurance? Because there's a guild of the Dalek builders or something as well, isn't it?
Yeah, there's an insurance premium they have to pay out every year to be insured to go inside.
Like, is this because that they might, you know, go off on a rampage and start exterminating people or what?
Probably.
I mean, I don't really get the Dalek builders thing and there are lots of Daleks around, but I wouldn't know how you could run a business refurbishing.
Are there enough Daleks?
Even in the Builders Guild, there can't be enough Daleks, surely, to maintain someone's business.
You'd probably be surprised. I remember being in Penzance, outside a junk shop in Penzance, and there in the window was a Dalek who was clearly in need of quite intensive TLC.
So you could have gone in with this guy's card and said, this is the man to get in touch with. By the way, your insurance premiums will go up.
I wonder if there are different levels to this insurance premium, whether you started off with bronze, and you went to imperial, and you went to gold.
You are the saddest man in this room.
You really are.
That is actually very funny.
Did you see the Black Dalek at breakfast?
I wish I'd
thought. You did indeed.
I think the Black Dalek at breakfast this morning, I think he built that, or helped build it.
It's funny because I was saying while I was watching the Black Dalek circulating and demanding cake.
He was the guy that ended up memeing in front of it.
It never ceases to amaze me that the Daleks which are built by enthusiasts are so much more superior to the ones that the BBC build. We did a launch for one of the Doctor Who games that I wrote, City of the Daleks. And we did the launch for that in Sheffield, outside Sheffield train station. And we had the new Daleks there, didn't we, Gary? You don't remember. And then there were these other Daleks that, you know, enthusiasts had brought up. They're all so much better.
I think it's because, I mean, the Dalek Builders Guild are fantastic, and I think it's because they build these Daleks by necessity sturdier materials.
That's
probably, BBC ones have to be lightweight and therefore they break quite easily. And I think these guys build their Daleks out of pretty much what Daleks would probably quite like to be built out of.
Absolutely.
And they're going around conventions and they've got to lug them around, they have to build them in a way that they're not going to fall apart.
They also look much more comfortable inside. They're far more comfortable inside as well from the look of them. Not that I'd ever be able to get into one, but yeah.
Well, Mark owns an original Kang gun from Paradise Towers, an original Tetrap gun.
Yes.
From town they're on. And they're rubbish, aren't they? They're exciting.
Dear Mike Tucker, two of your handiworks have just been described. Don't ever do this podcast. They think your work's rubbish. No netting came out of it.
Some random guy who somebody knew said, "I've had these things and I'm getting rid of them. I think they used to be in Doctor Who," and he handed them to me. Said, "You like Doctor Who, don't you? You can have these." And I was like, "Well, I don't know what they are." I checked it out, and yes, it was a Kang crossbow. It's the dummy Tetrap gun that Bonnie fires, because it has a firework thing in it, doesn't it? A pyrotechnic effect that goes off, and the end of it appears to be slightly burnt and have a little thing in it,
right?
Pyrotechnic.
Do either of you own any props?
Do you own props?
No. Don't think so.
I have Sarah Jane's owl from the attic, from Sarah Jane Adventures, and I have the Trickster's box. I just did an arm movement there, which no one on the podcast can see. But that was my impersonation of the trickster holding out the box.
Is that her original owl from when she left at the end of...
No, the original owl from Hand of Fear died many, many years ago. When, I believe the story goes, and I can say this because it's Sadie that tells this story, that Sadie, when she was very, very young, threw up over it. So it had to be thrown away. But this owl, Liz turned up with herself when they did the pilot for Sarah Jane Adventures and said, I bought an owl, and it's an exact copy of the owl.
Oh, brilliant.
And it sat on the set for the next 5 years. And after she died, Russell gave it to me and said, I think you need to take care of the owl. So I did.
Oh,
and then when I left the BBC, he gave me the Trickster's
box. The owl
box.
Came with you. I'll turn the Trickster's box.
Oh. I think the fairly once fairly common. My sister had one. An owl, not a Trickster's box.
There's certainly a firm in America, big fan firm in America, that make duplicate owls. Yeah.
Are they insured?
No. Well, you see, it's quite easy to sort of insure a Dalek, I'm sure, because it's big and comes in. I think if you said, I'd like to insure a fluffy owl, even the average insurance company will go, there's something wrong with you, isn't there?
Is there an owl refurbishment problem?
There should be.
There's a business owner there.
I've got
an
idea. How have you enjoyed the convention so far?
It's been good, as far as I'm aware.
I don't know if whenever Phil answers a question like that, he looks at me.
Well, it's because Gary...
It's like the script editor. What do I say?
Exactly. that's it. Yeah. All
he
of my creative
control.
For so many years, all of my creativity was just run through you, wasn't it? You were my filter. So,
yes,
yeah,
Phil, I have allowed you to enjoy this weekend.
Thank you very much. Gary has allowed me to enjoy the weekend. So, yeah.
He's talking to William. Gave us the church line.
Church line? Oh, it was Matthew Jacobs, wasn't it? He said in his panel he thought that today was... Or I don't know whether he was actually referring to the actual room, but he said he felt like it was like a church. Like, you had an altar where you go up to the top.
Oh,
and
see.
The seats either side. So it was like attending church.
You know, there is an interesting is pushing it. There is a parallel to be drawn between religious... fanaticism, if you like,
yes,
and being a fan of a TV show or fan of a band, or it is quite religious in the sense of people will go and congregate somewhere to worship, see, speak to, whatever, somebody in the equivalent of a pulpit that is talking to them.
To hear the gospel of
the gospel of the Doctor Who or the gospel of the Star Trek, or you go and see a band live, and it's, you know, you go and particularly if you see a lot of EDM music, and that's very church-like because that is a lot of people standing in a lot of rows, sort of dancing to somebody standing on a stage who's not necessarily playing instruments, but is playing a lot of computers and playing a lot. And there's something quite religious and iconographic about that.
Can I just bring back to Doctor Who? So Waters Mars has become something that's very much the kind of, like the... What's the really scary ones from when we were growing up? The Deadly Assassin? Pyramids of Mars,
really?
Perhaps?
Green Death?
Yeah.
That one always freaked me out.
Yes, see, I think Waters of Mars was that for another generation. Because my daughter was born in...
You should know this.
Yes, you should.
Kind of something that should just trip off your tongue at this point.
2000. She's
right.
She's 2000. So, that's a very good age for your daughter.
So, yeah. So, yes. So she's born in 2000.
Yeah.
So when Waters Mars came on, she was what? So
Nine,
thank you. And she'd been avidly watching Doctor Who up until Waters Mars. And she didn't watch again for about 2 years.
Really? I scared her that much.
Absolutely.
Oh, that is wonderful.
She still cannot watch that episode.
She still can't get in the shower.
No.
So she still thinks David Tennant's the Doctor because she never saw him leave.
So when she tunes in next time,
it'll be like
that. No. Then she restarted watching during about Spin City. I think she rejoined about series 6. But yes, yeah, so for a couple, there was a couple of years where she just, that was it. She was done. Absolutely.
How wonderful.
Like
how wonderful. Really? What was it that terrified her about it?
I think it's particularly the people, the transformation.
The flood.
Yes. Yeah, the transformation of the flood. The people. I mean, that disturbed me as well. I found that very disturbing. That,
excellent.
That, yeah.
Well, we were just saying in the green room that the great thing about it being water is if you really were in a situation in life where touching any form of water potentially is going to kill you, and you look around wherever you are on this planet and go, I am never more than about 6 inches away from some kind of water.
Absolutely.
It would be terrifying if we had something like
that.
But I thought the idea of making water terrifying.
Of which we are 60%.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. I think you're right about the transformation, because the bit that I remember was, character's name, but just starts convulsing in the background.
Maggie.
Yeah, just starts convulsing. And at that point, cynical 20-year-old Aiden goes, This is going to be good.
Fans for certain days, this is wonderful. This was manner, you know.
But I always remember. I remember the Radio Times front cover. Is this the scariest Doctor Who story ever? Mm. The lieutenant in the space suit and Mars behind him. Was it held back for Halloween as well?
It was originally going to be a
November.
Yeah, well, originally it was a Christmas episode. It went out on the 21st of November. It was originally going to be a Christmas episode.
And then
because of the wonderful way that the BBC works, they changed their mind, and it was going to go. And it went out on the 21st of November,
which was the date,
if I remember correctly, the 21st of November, 2059. Is when Bowie Base 1 blows up.
Wasn't that part of that old BBC advert because of the unique way that the BBC works?
Because one of the other things that we had it as a Christmas episode was at the beginning, in the final version, Yuri comes out with the solar panel writing No Trespassers.
Mm-hmm.
In Phil's original script, he's putting a Christmas tree, he's putting Christmas lights on a... it's an antenna, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's turning it into a Christmas tree.
Okay.
And Adelaide is inside saying, Peter O'Brien's character is going, what are you doing? You're wasting...
That's a waste of an antenna,
yes.
Or whatever it is.
But yeah, he was putting up a Christmas tree.
When you're writing something like that, do you specifically stop and think, now what's the most universal thing I can think of to scare people with? Or do you in retrospect think, actually that was even more scary than I anticipated it would be because it's so universal?
I don't know. I mean, I think the universality of whatever it is that you're using to scare people is certainly quite useful. But it wasn't a question of me sitting down and thinking, what's the scariest thing I can... I know, water that'll transform you. It was, I mean, the origin of Waters of Mars was the simple fact that the Mars lander that NASA had put on there had recently discovered evidence of water on Mars. This was the conversation that we had in Cardiff Bay when we were talking about what it was going to be. And the idea that there was water on Mars, I think instantly... The idea was, you have settlers that go and settle there. The fact is that water is the thing on which all biologies depend. That everybody has to have water. And what if that water becomes your enemy?
Yeah.
You know, so it kind of, in a way, kind of then writes itself to some extent. And I always had this idea of the drowned zombies, which for me was quite a... I mean, zombies are kind of a scary idea. We've now, following The Walking Dead and all of the other things that have shambled along in its footsteps, we're very familiar with zombies. At the time when we were thinking about it, I think it was something that was fairly new on television at least. And the idea of zombies that had been rotted by water... was kind of, I can see that. That scares me.
For me, the horror comes from it's the erosion of the personality and the character. Because that was always Terror of the Zygons was a terrified me when I was a kid. And should I impart the bones?
Do.
I would have been about five, and I had a plastic boat in my bedroom, and I was so terrified that I couldn't get up and go to the toilet, so I had to use the boat. So that's the sign of a good...
Don't touch the water, not one drop.
Judging by Gary's face, I can see my reticence. well judged.
No, not at all. I think it's very important that you tell everybody in podcast that you peed in a boat when you were five. And I think this is something that hopefully your daughter will hear and will be able to bring up at various times in your lifetime.
Well, no doubt.
To humiliate you.
Well, if my daughter is listening, also, Phil's not saying sorry.
I'm certainly not saying sorry.
When we review that story now, we call it, if it's a scary one, we call it a full
How many boats? How many boats is that all? So,
yeah. I like that.
But, so the... yeah, so Mars, water Mars. If I'd been my daughter's age, I think it would have been a good four boats.
When they built these two new, you know, they keep boasting about these two new aircraft carriers. Their Royal Navy's largest ever, whatever. When they built those, oh, brilliant! They've now got this expands Doctor Who's ability to scare people now, doesn't it? we've now got something that previously we would have said, oh, that's a schooner full.
Oh, right, yeah.
Scare.
No, it's just saying, that's an aircraft.
That's an HMS Queen Elizabeth.
Right.
And that's a scare.
Right.
Yeah. No, but the point I was trying to make was that obviously in that,
I will be deleting that
who they think, yeah, they looked the same, but you had Harry like chasing Sarah Jane, you know, and it's all threatening Sarah Jane, and it's all terrifying. It's that erosion of the character.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big thing in Doctor Who history. And Philip Hinchcliffe, of course. Of Diagons was a very big fan of this, which is possession.
Yes.
Which is taking the human and turning them into something they're not. And that's a big theme in sort of mid-70s Doctor Who.
Yes.
And
well, there is nothing scarier of believing yourself to have changed. You know, if you the lovely scary thing is that, okay, in terms of the flood in Waters of Mars, that the flood take you over, and there's all the body horror of the flood, you know, the skin that's cracking and the eyes that change and the water that kind of envelops you and everything. But on top of that is the suspicion that although the flood are doing their flood thing, you know, and taking over of the people on the base and all of that, there's a suspicion that somewhere inside there, the original people that lived in those bodies are still in there, and they're seeing all of this happen. Oh. They're seeing what they're doing, and they can't do a thing about it. So they're kind of locked in.
With Peter O'Brien's character.
Well, exactly.
He is transformed, and he still manages to blow himself to pieces.
Yes, and in
that moment of humanity.
And in the novelisation version, you will find a great little section, little bit on that. Excellent.
Have you written a novelisation, Phil, of Waters of Mars?
Funny you should ask. Funny you should
talk about that.
Oh, yes. Well, what would you like to know?
I don't know, how much have you added from what your original script, your original idea to?
When you say added, the novel is probably relatively faithful to the... Because what's the point of writing a novel and a novelisation of the Waters of Mars and completely changing it and everything? But there are certain surprises in there. There are certain things. The beautiful thing about doing a target is that you can take something and expand it, and you can look at it and say, well, what happened before? How did they get there? Who actually were they? And my favourite part of the parts that I've added is... the story about Adelaide when she was a little girl. There's a lot more to that story than you actually saw on screen. Yeah, through the attic window. There's what happened, what brought her to that point, you know, which is, I think, my favourite part of when I was writing it, writing the novel. So, yeah, that's it.
But that's absolutely fair, though.
Sure.
I think that's absolutely fair, because when I was young, the big change would be something a little more than... They'd stick the prologue on the front.
Oh, you mean the target novel?
The Silurians looking up at the moon just before they're going underground or whatever. And then you go to the other extreme, which is probably Ian Marter doing the Santana stratagem. No, experiment, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where he almost, I suppose with only two episodes you have to, goes off at a complete tangent, doesn't he? I think that's perfectly reasonable, that.
Thank you.
I was watching Waters of Mars this week in preparation for this amazing weekend, and I had forgotten there's a line in it where Peter O'Brien's character says to Adelaide, "You never did forgive me." And I'm positive that in the original scripts, we knew what that was a reference to, but of course none of that's there. So I assume that's all gone into the book, because I can't remember what she never forgave him for.
Was it "you never forgive me" or "you never gave us a chance"?
Oh, maybe it was that. Maybe
he never gave us a chance.
Was there a romance then between them? Is that what it was?
Well, it's kind of hinted. Well, you know, I'm not going to give away the wonderfully mystical turns of the Waters of Mars. You've got to get out there and buy it.
I've got a confession to make. Waters of Mars. I find it hard to forgive you for this. The Waters of Mars made me think.
It doesn't happen often.
But you know the whole thing we have about how is it Doctor Wonderful because we can enjoy it at so many levels of age. And I think we tend to think, don't we, that as we're becoming, I don't know, students or people with own families, we can enjoy the witty little bits that children won't get. But it occurred to me, because what really terrified me, not terrified me, but really made me
shiver.
Was Adelaide topping herself at the end.
Mm.
And you think, oh, actually, it can scare you on different levels as well, doesn't it? Which I suppose, in a way, is different levels of understanding, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an example of Adelaide's courage.
Yeah.
You know, that she does that in order to reset time.
Yeah. I don't mean the scariest of someone just putting a gun to the head. I mean the scariest of the implications of...
Well, exactly. Yeah, you know, but I mean, that's all going back to the whole Time Lord Victorious thing and the Doctor going a little bit off the rails for a while. But I mean, I think, again, having watched that quite recently because of doing the novel, you know, it was... it's a beautiful bit of telly. That last 10 minutes of Waters of Mars, which was all Russell's, is a beautiful piece of television. It really is.
I'd forgotten when I was talking on stage, Ed, about editorial policy and saying...
Ed Poll. For years and years, I was wondering, who is this Ed Poll? Because he's a miserable...
I remember having... I don't know if we had a huge problem, but it was certainly brought up by them that we were having... suicide on Doctor Who.
Well, it was the
fact. I can't think there's ever been a situation in Doctor Who previously, classic or modern, where someone has literally committed suicide as opposed to sacrificing themselves.
Well, as I said before, I mean, I was horrified when I read Russell's draft. When you're talking, because in my version, she didn't commit suicide.
There's an image of the Fendar, isn't there, where the Doctor.
Oh, that's right, gives the gun to Max Stone.
Yes. When we reviewed that recently, you were quite shocked. One of you was quite shocked at that, weren't you?
It's a shocking thing to do.
Mm. And I think it's justified. Some people say that it's gratuitous, but for me, it's not
because it's off screen and it's justified. But I know that one of the things that we had to make sure of, which I said we had to make sure it was obvious anyway, but they requested, was that Adelaide didn't use a gun. She used a sci-fi gun.
So it wasn't
something that is imitable.
Zap, I suppose.
It had to be a zap rather than a...
Because who's the annoying Scotsman in Death of the Daleks? Annoying Scots, that's more a dig back at Stephen and Rob yesterday, where he hides out on the Dalek ship and he blows it up.
Yes,
that's suicide, but it's nothing like...
No, that's self-sacrifice.
That's a completely different thing.
I think when it's not on screen... Your mind and your imagination fills in the blanks and can make it a hell of a lot scarier.
Funny you should say that as well. Read the novel.
Yes, in the novel, Phil clearly is going to describe in intricate detail the laser blast blowing in the head into 20,000 million atoms.
And
the last thing that went through her brain was, oh no, I shouldn't have done this.
Adelaide had just redecorated her living room. Odd that it was that her last ever actually did it again.
I think Ed Paul is... It would be fighting against that sort of thing showing on screen because it's bad for children or because they fear criticism.
It's a tiny little bit of the latter. It is what they call imitable behaviour, and that is what, in a family show, you try and avoid.
The Daily Mail is never going to say, are they? Young boy, traumatised by BBC, blows himself on a Dalek spaceship. But if some mother boy puts a gun to his head and his bedroom...
Well, that's it, exactly.
It's a laser gun, it's a sci-fi gun, that imitable behaviour clause goes out the window.
But you just
have to balance that.
It's all learned.
Yeah. But that's not just a problem that Doctor Who has to... Every show has to worry about that.
Was there an action line after the episode?
Not that I remember.
No, okay.
Because not many people tend to be concerned about, you know, time being...
If you have been upset by the same time and you feel you have been denied a future as an astronaut, ring this number now.
I'm intrigued by the fact that Waltz the Mask was intended to be a Christmas special. Does that mean there was going to be regeneration at the end of it, originally?
There were a bunch of... knew they were all going to be around Christmas.
Oh, okay, right. So I always thought if the Tenth Doctor had regenerated that at the end of the Waters of Mars, that probably would have made it my favourite Tenth Doctor story.
No, he's doing that because he hates the Tenth Doctor.
Because
everything's been pushed up to the level and to the point that someone's had to kill themselves to make the Doctor see that he's gone too far. I just then thought, yeah, it serves you bloody right.
There is an element of that because, of course, the whole point of the Doctor being on Mars at that point is because Carmen, at the end of Planet of the Dead, has kind of said, you know, well, not three times, he's going through the dark, and basically so your song is over. And so the reason that the Doctor goes to Mars in the first place is to kind of get his head around all of that and the fact that his song is coming to an end, and he wants a bit of space and a bit of peace and quiet to kind of get rid of that. And what does he find? You know, the TARDIS has dumped him there at a time when actually people are back on Mars. But by the end, if you remember, after she has shot herself in the head with the pulse pistol, not a real gun, a sci-fi gun, yeah, Sigma appears, and the Doctor says, "Is this my time? Is this when I die?" So he is expecting to die at that. He's thinking, you know, and I think the reason that he's thinking that is because he realizes that he has gone too far, you know, and thinks that maybe he does deserve to die at that point.
Maybe you could do some sequels to it, because if what Alec Adelaide used was a Kang crossbow. She may well have survived it. So, talking about, you scripted End of Time, didn't you, Gary?
So I'm trying to get where you get this idea that if you put a crossbow to the side of your head and fire it, it might survive.
He's got quite thick skulls.
One made by the BBC props department, you probably could.
You
scripted End of Time, didn't you?
Yes.
Which of you was it? It was reminding me yesterday about, you know, the thing about, oh, I wish he'd uncovered his face inside the little glass cube when Milford said you were on it.
That was me. He said, because the moment when he's radiation poisoning, I always thought, oh, it would have just been so cool and so bold. Of when he unfurls himself, he's just Matt Smith there and then. He's actually regenerated while he was dying from the thing. In my head.
You're weird.
That would have been good.
You're weird. No, it wouldn't.
You're just wrong.
The fact that the Doctor says that as a point to be judged, I don't want to go. You know, I mean, that's the most heart-rending
thing. And now he comes back?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, but isn't it...
That'll be exposed,
I think. That's supposed to sound quite rude, but... Isn't it also one of the most...
It's
a heartbreak. Is it also, in the sense of one of the things that people moan about the Day of the Doctor about, but, I don't want to go, it's me, bloody me.
Well, people might think that. Yeah.
He says it in, that's his parting line in Day of the Doctor as well, isn't it? He says, I need somewhere else to go, because I don't want to go. Like that, I think, as well. I think it's been, David Bradley used it as well in, Adventure in Space and Time.
Yes, he did.
But I mean, I think the point of that is that it's very easy to kind of imagine the Doctor as, which is very true, is that he just goes on and on and on, and that he has these, you know, every now and again there'll be a regeneration, but it's still the Doctor, and that is true. But nevertheless, that Doctor has a personality of his own.
Yes.
And I think it's reasonable to think that a man who has lived multiple lifetimes and may well be very much aware that he's just going to come back in another guise. But nevertheless, I actually kind of like, I enjoy what I've done. You know, this lifetime has been great. I don't want it to end.
The older I get, it speaks to me for stages of life. That bit in the cafe and saying, oh, some other man goes sauntering away. You can look back at pictures of yourself. And even me, you know, I'm 34 in a couple of months, but, you know, I look at pictures of me when I was 18. And sometimes I go, that guy was an idiot. I quite like that guy. He's not me anymore. He is me, but he's not me anymore.
Well, that's very true.
Because you're old, and you change over time. That's kind of how I see that lovely little bit between Wilf and the Doctor. It's just both. There's parts of you as you grow older that you leave behind. You change.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right.
As writers both, an interesting thing that Stephen said, yes, were you at Stephen's in Stephen's panel yesterday? Where you were quite...
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Sorry.
Mark is currently chewing on a caramel.
We said at the time on the Terence Dix event earlier in the year. Outrage, by the way, since the Riverside has something to close. You seen this?
No.
They're effectively going into receivership.
Yeah. That's a shame.
Is that we were quite taken aback at how funny and good Stephen Moffat is in the flesh. But he's said that he was talking to on the stage about... I've forgotten the point I was making now. Hang on, because it was very significant.
Mm-hmm.
Script editing. he was joking, partly, that when he was taking over the mantle from Russell, he kept saying to Russell, so how much work actually is involved in this? And Russell kept putting him off. And then on the last day, he dumps a pile of first draft script. Obviously, it was... must have been a slight exaggeration. But one of the things he says in answer to a question that the thing that surprised him most about the job was just how much
work it is
that the script that the script editor slash showrunner adds in on top of the...
Don't mix up showrunners and script editors. You showrunner in the world killing you. Doctor Who is a hero. I think one of the first things I remember learning from Russell was he said, you know, people will come up and submit an idea for a Doctor Who, fully experienced writers, been writing for dozens of years, and they'll put it down because they're used to writing 50-minute dramas on TV, an episode of, I don't know, some crime drama or something like that. Or bad girls, and they'll put it down, or footballers' wives, you know, good cultured programmes that people might write, and they'll go, there's my idea for a 50-minute television episode of Doctor Who, and Russell will look at it and go, yeah, that's great, so that's the pre-credit sequence, what are you going to do for the other 49 minutes? And they would go, no, that's a 50-minute idea, yeah. And he'd go, no, in Doctor Who, that takes up that amount of time because we are a unique show, it's fast-paced, and people don't realise how difficult it is to write an episode of Doctor Who because you have to have an idea that can sustain that pace and that speed and that amount of dialogue and interaction and adventure across 50 minutes, where most TV, and we think TV is fast-paced today, but if you compare an episode of Happy Valley with an episode of Doctor Who and watch the progression of the story across those 50 minutes, an episode of Happy Valley would fit into the pre-credit sequence of Doctor Who in terms of storytelling. Yeah, and it's very difficult for writers to realise just how hard Doctor Who is to write. The amount of people who have, over the years, very big experienced writers, have come in and gone, yeah, I'd like to do a Doctor Who, and they don't. They get sort of into their third meeting and just go, yeah, that's not how I want to write. That's not how I can write.
This is something that is unusual about Doctor Who.
It's totally new to Doctor Who.
It's not just people coming to completely new to TV.
No. I'm talking about people who've been writing since, you know, for the last 20
or
30 years.
Very well known writers.
Lots of famous people came up.
Stephen Fry was supposed to write the series too, wasn't he?
You know, and it's just, it's a show that eats up story, and people don't realise, and therefore, I find it very frustrating when people sit down and slag off scripts and things like that, and go, oh, I could write that script so much better. Doctor fans are very good at saying they could write Doctor Who, and they couldn't. They could write about 30 seconds worth of Doctor Who.
Yeah, it can't simply be the pace of it, in this case, it's...
No, it's the amount of a program like Doctor Who, because it's fantasy, because it's family, because it's fast-paced, it doesn't fit any normal pigeonholes of any other drama, and it eats up story. Because to keep it going, every event, every emotional beat, everything like that, that normally could be stretched over 10 minutes in an episode of Happy Valley, takes 10 seconds in Doctor Who.
It's true. It's, if you think about something, especially big hits like Blink, for instance, the fact that that's a single episode, in a way, my memory almost doesn't remember it like that. It seems like it should almost be like a
two-parter.
Yeah. But the fact that they cram so much in, that so many story points and plot beats.
Yes, because you don't get the whatever the Time Lord equivalent would be in Happy Valley of the Doctor's sister just washing up at the sink while her sister's coming over putting the washing in. They're putting the shopping in.
You don't get that, but it's very interesting to note that when Doctor Who first came back and with Rose, you do kind of get that kind of sense of that sense of domesticity, that sense of place, and also that sense of actually, I'm quite comfortable watching this, watching a science fiction show on BBC when there hasn't been a science fiction show on BBC for 10 years or whatever it was. And so people were kind of familiar with soap, if you like. And that was why, for me, when Doctor Who first came back in 2005, there were elements of what I felt like soap, which I admit I was uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And yet it was Russell playing a blinder,
of course, absolutely.
Because he absolutely knew what would hook people, and that he didn't want, that he wasn't going to be ramming sci-fi down their throats from the straight on.
Is there an element of that where if Rose, first thing in Rose is Rose's alarm clock goes off, she's getting ready to go to work, let's say she's just getting herself a piece of toast, and her mum makes some snarky remark about her about having airs and graces working in a shop or something. In EastEnders, that would probably be played for
absolutely. It's an episode of EastEnders.
Relationship with the mother.
Yeah, exactly.
Doctor Who, it's
all of that is there, and yet it's dealt with so quickly, so succinctly. That it's there. You notice, and you don't notice that suddenly. Okay, you're being chased around by Altons.
But you're right. In a normal drama, that sequence would be half an episode, because that's the pace television drama moves at. So writers come into Doctor Who used to that pace of television, sit down and think, well, I can write that scene, and you sit there and go, you can write that scene, however it'll eventually be truncated to one line because we've got to move on, and for a lot of writers that's a really hard thing to adjust to, because Doctor Who is utterly unique for that.
When I've heard people like Russell and Steve that saying in the past, you don't realise how difficult it is to write for Doctor Who, I'm thinking, they're saying, it's because it's a really, really serious and complex show. It's almost the opposite, isn't it? It's not so serious that you can't just write it.
Because it has to, it's doing this thing that is almost unique in television in Britain, of the family drama. So every single thing in an episode of Doctor Who has to appeal to every single person watching that show.
Yeah.
And you have to keep them occupied. So the kids will love that beat, and then the parents love that beat, the kids love that beat, the teenagers love that beat. And that, it's this pace all the time. There's no let up for 45, 50 minutes. It's exhausting to write that and to keep it going. And it takes geniuses, and Russell, absolutely top of the world genius. Mm-hmm. It takes a genius to be able to write something like that and put emotional punch in, and put laughs in, and put drama in, and you don't notice it's happening.
Mm.
You just sit there, and suddenly at the end of 50 minutes, you go, I've just watched an episode of Doctor Who. And he makes it look easy, and it isn't.
Do you think Russell gets the credit? Because Russell is quite this jolly, joking around interviews guy. But he gets the credit, he makes fair for just how skilled he is.
I think he's the smartest man I've ever met in my life. I think he's so intelligent, and so clever, and
oh, we're just reinforcing
that. He's exceptional.
He is exceptional. I've never met anybody like him, and he's exceptional on so many different levels as well. I've seen him. I mean, we've both seen him come in before a script meeting, and because he was so busy, hasn't had chance to read a script fully, and he'll He'll sit out there and read the script and come into that meeting. And he's as hot as hot shit.
I remember there was one episode, one of Joe's episodes, and there was a room. It was you, me and Julie and Nikki and Joe sitting in a room at Upper Boat. And Russell wasn't there because he was busy. And I can't remember what it was. It was the Woman in the Attic episode. And there was a problem in it, that there was a logic problem of trying to get people from A to B within this episode of Sarah Jane that would make sense in the story and also be possible and filmable. And we had sat there for about half an hour, back and forth, back and forth. And Russell walked into this room. Oh, hello. Oh, how is everybody? And Julie said, we just hit this problem with this scene where boom, 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 and we can't this, and we can't do that, and we can't do this. And Russell just went, oh, it's easy. They do that, they do that. Then that person does that. They'll be there, boom, boom. And he walked out of the room again. And we just sat there and went, we've been here for half an hour trying to work out. And that is the genius of the man, that he just comes in and he sees writing. He sees scripts, I think, in 3D. Mm. He can look at a page of script and in front of him, he is seeing it like a 3D magic eye puzzle, and he can go through it, and he can go, we're here, we need to get to there, and that's the route we take. And other people can't see that.
Like Russell's mind palace.
Yeah, absolutely. But the other thing about Russell is that he's unlike anybody else that I've ever met in terms of a script meeting, in being able to just generate enthusiasm and new ideas. Now, I think he's a massively generous person.
Generosity is the word, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And there was a script that I think it was on Sarah Jane that we were working on as well, and it just wasn't working. I can't remember who it was that was writing, and it doesn't matter who it was that was writing it. And there was a sense among those of us in that meeting that the writer wasn't a part of the meeting, that maybe this was, you know, we'd gone as far as we could do with this writer. And I can clearly remember Russell meeting this writer and bringing him down and building him up at exactly the same time, and to the point that writer then turned out this fabulous script. You know, and I don't think there's anybody else I've ever met who could do that. And it's not only his genius in terms of, as Gary was saying, being this kind of mind palace kind of idea of being able to see his way through a script, but also in the way to invest in a writer who's not as experienced, to give them the will and the creative ability and the freedom to actually make themselves better.
Yes.
And that is another part of Russell's genius.
It's fantastic.
That he can make people better just simply by being nice.
And, you know, you use the word generous, which I was going to say as well, because what he will do in a script meeting is everyone's coming up with ideas, bashing ideas around, and Russell's coming up with them as well. But Russell will never come up with an idea and say, that's my idea. Yeah. If he comes up with an idea that for someone else's script, it's theirs, 100%. He just gives it to them, and half the time you don't even know he's given it to them. Your brain doesn't quite work out that actually Russell said that, and you'll go away thinking, oh, we've done this fantastic, brilliant job, and at the back of it, no, Russell put all that stuff. But at no point does he ever sit down 3 months later and go, don't forget, that was my idea. He's not built like that. He has no ego in that sense at all. He's just about making everybody look brilliant.
In that case, Jim, that went brilliantly for us, thanks. Sorry about us scrabbling around at the beginning trying to find a hook to get into a really interesting conversation.
Well, but I think we're just having a bit of a chat.
It wasn't going to be that down to the 10 minutes of you two sounding very clever.
Can I just ask you, Gary,
I thought...
And like you said last night, feel free to get your own back on the TV movie book that I completely destroyed.
I thought you were about to present him with a glass of wine, like Tony does. Before you go, Gary.
It's Aiden, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
A-I-D-N?
H-A-Y-D-N.
H-A-Y-D-N, right.
Excuse me,
I was going to ask you a question about Captain Scarlet.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Huge Captain Scarlet fan. I haven't found the time to...
That's okay. Another time?
Yeah.
I did almost mention Captain Scarlet, actually, at one point.
My little 2-year-old son
has
got a hold of all the old toys of mine from about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
and has been playing with them lots at the moment. Instead of Love, I've seen Doors, Captain Scarlet. I brought one of Jeff Cummins' artworks out there.
All right.
And I was going to see something as well, but I don't have it in my bag. So I may have to join the queue later.
Fair enough. It might not be a very long queue.
It makes our queue look better.
Yeah. No, thank you so much for working your
pleasure. Time. You're welcome.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, it is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.